Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 179 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast that is a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me, as always, is my very tricksy hostess, Aaron Paulette. How are you doing, Aaron?
With you, as always. I'm back for one episode, and now suddenly you're taking me for granted again.
Well, I didn't know if I didn't want to be too repetitive, and the fact that you keep flashing shiny objects on the screen while I'm trying to start the show, I wanted to make it that thing. Plus, I wanted to give you a little victory lap for the main show, too. The only reason why this show is existing right now is because Aaron Paulette is allowing me to do it.
Weird tipped me off about his weakness, and apparently if you just keep slamming that Jafe bar in Discord and picking stuff, it'll distract him, and he can't think, and he's got to stop and watch them. And it's just like dangling keys in front of an infant. Ooh, must have.
Hilariously, we used to change my we put the changing pad. We did not change my daughter's diaper on the dining room table. We put the changing pad for changing my daughter's diaper onto the dining room table, and we found that she would hold still long enough for us to do what needed to get done. If we took just my wife would just take the push the chandelier just a little bit, and just so it would go side to side. She'd just be like, oh, it's moving. Quick, change your pants before she gets bored. Well, we've been laughing ourselves silly. So, mm-hmm. How are you doing, Aaron?
I'm doing surprisingly well. Just the last hour or so has really lifted my spirits. Not that things have really been bad, but you know, we're heading into Christmas and all the assorted stress, and that's really not my favorite time of year. But hopefully, with us downsizing, with Dad in the VA, hopefully Mom will not try and do everything all at once, and it'll make her a little less crazy. And so I'm clearing out Dad's library because, well, we need the room, and honestly, we need the money. And I found some really, really nice books he has. And, you know, we're talking like the leather cover with the title done in gold. And the edges of the pages are gilt. Mm-hmm. And each one comes with its own ribbon bookmark. It's like, these are nice. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, I should sell these. I wonder if people would give me $25 for them. And people are going, no, you are pricing yourself out. And so I asked my friends, the Anjuirdans, who are librarians, and they did a lot of hard work for me, and I appreciate that. And they gave me the ballpark estimates of these books, and wow, some of them are let's just say that the average price for some of these is somewhere like around $75. Mm. And so, okay, wow, this is good. So I've got to figure out, I mean, I've bought things from eBay before, so I'm not a stranger to eBay, but I've never sold anything on eBay before, and I've got to figure out how to do that, because it would be really great if when I sell these, you know, we'd be able to pay off a credit card. That would be just fantastic. And some of these books, I mean, I'm just going to give you an overview right now. I'm not going to get into the whole deal. When I finally put them up for sale, I will mention them to you. But I know that there are some books that a lot of people, like David, when he hears this, he's just going to start drooling. A Complete Guide to Hand Loading.
Ooh.
Is one of them. A Rifleman Went to War. The Gun and Its Development. And again, these are the really nice presentation quality things. So,
yeah, you may have to hit me in on a few of those, because yeah, you may not need to put them up on eBay. I'm just saying.
Well, without getting into specifics, if things go over the asking price, that would be good for us. Mm-hmm. Not just because, you know, oh, money's always good, but it's just like, again, if we could pay off a credit card, that'd be great.
I hear you.
But yes, I will definitely let friends know when these go up for auction on eBay. And so you'll know, and David will know, and a whole bunch of other people will know. And so, it's not specifically good news, but it's not bad news. And it's like, okay, well, hey, this is something I can do. Mm-hmm. So, I'm trying to get things done in my limited free time.
Oh, limited free time.
Gee, remember when you were a kid and you thought, oh, it'll be so great when I'm a grown-up because I can do whatever I want whenever I want? Mm-hmm. How are you doing, Weird?
I'm doing well. The hilarious bit of that was I was up in Maine for Thanksgiving and with my daughter and my parents, and they're happy to be playing with her and all that, and I'm happy to not be playing with her because that's my job. And so it's one of those, like, I just plopped in front of Dad's computer and started playing NetHack and all that. My parents come in like, look at you, all you're doing is sitting there on your phone. I'm like, yes, because I have time all of a sudden. I'm not at my house, so therefore I can't be editing podcasts. And you're playing with my daughter, so I don't have to be taking care of her. I've got nothing to do, and I am enjoying myself.
So you got the package I sent you, and you have exhibited remarkable self-restraint and haven't opened it yet.
I have not.
How long is that going to last?
It is going to last until our agreed upon point where we decide close enough to Christmas that we're going to open stuff on air.
Oh, okay.
Because that worked out so last time. Because, oh my God, Hound, there he is. It's actually, Hound is literally standing like on top of the package. He's guarding.
Does he still have the sassy pose?
Oh God, I can't change it. I can't change the fact that my daughter had him pop in a hip, just like sassy Hound. I kind of want to play with him and transform him a few times, but also I don't want to ruin it. home again, and back to work. So I think we shall shift into main topic. And the first one is one that, like, I won't lie, I was a little bit puckered up on. I had done a ton of research and listened to a lot of legal minds, and I was pretty much sure thing that Ahmaud Arbery, the verdict was going to go through, in favor of Ahmaud being the victim of murder. And it did go through. And I was terrified, like, when they were reading the verdict. Look, literally, I was just doing dishes. I can't remember what I was doing, but I was in my kitchen, and suddenly my phone chimed, and it was Steve, and Steve said, "Oh, they're reading the verdict," and I quickly fired it up, and I was overjoyed to hear that it went that way, because one, I would have been. The big thing is that I feel like it was murder. I absolutely think that's the correct verdict of how it went. And then two, I didn't want to have egg on my face of saying, oh yeah, no, these guys are, this is a dirty shoot, this is a bad shirt, and have them be exonerated.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. And of course my cynical self predicted that, oh, the news is going to give this a big leaving alone because, oh, the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict is like tainted with racism and blah, 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 blah. But like suddenly three white guys with some fairly credible allegations of being racist themselves gunned down a black man who himself was not a saint. You know, they're going to get life in prison. And what is his name? Travis McMichael. He's facing the death penalty. We'll see in the sentencing if they go that far. Actually, I wouldn't be surprised if he does get death for it, because he got the murder with malice.
Mm-hmm. For people who are curious, and I had to ask around about this, the reason why it's called malice murder is because, well, Georgia has its own little way of doing things. What Georgia calls malice murder, we would call premeditated murder, or murder in the first degree. And so they don't have manslaughter, they just have regular murder. So for us, it's premeditated versus manslaughter, and Georgia has malice murder versus non-malice, regular vanilla murder. So maybe that explains a little bit, because I had a lot of confusion. It's like, what with Mel's murder? Does that mean it's hate crime? So, yeah, that's been answered.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's anything else to cover, because we pretty much covered the case was over by the time we recorded last week. So really, it's just and they haven't done the sentencing yet. So that's it. I just wanted to point that out, and I am again disappointed that the news media is spending all this time talking about Kyle Rittenhouse and how awful it is, and what a terrible trial it was, and you know, never mind all the judicial oversteps that District Attorney Binger did, but this somehow claim that the judge it was some sort of Trump plant or something like that, despite the fact that he's a lifelong Democrat. The news wants to tell a story, and they don't care how true it is.
Yeah, unfortunately, you are correct. All right, so let's talk about another shooting that's in the news, and one that's, well, it's less clear cut to me. Mm-hmm. By this point, I think it's about everyone has seen the video of the Chad Reed shooting. If you don't know who that is, that's the video that was taken from two different viewpoints, and there's a large angry man in like a teal shirt arguing with a smaller man in a black shirt with a pistol caliber carbine, and you know they're arguing because, well, it's about custody. The man is divorced, and he's at the home of his ex-wife and her new lover, and he's there to pick up his son, because he's got visitation. Or maybe they have visitation, and he's picking them up? I'm not really sure. But anyway, the child is not there, and Mr. Reed is justifiably angry. And the other man in question, I don't know if he owns the home, or if he's just living there with the ex-wife who might own the home. But
by the way, I believe in all my readings of the story, I believe they're still married. They're just they're separated in the process of a divorce.
Okay, you're right, but you're wrong.
Okay.
So there are two Mrs. Reeds here.
Okay.
So Chad Reed married Christina Reed, and they got divorced. Then he married someone else, and she is the one, his current wife, who is filming it from the car.
I gotcha.
Now the separation, so the other man, Kyle somebody or other, he is currently separated from, perhaps divorcing, Anne Marie somebody or other. Mm-hmm. And she's like a district judge.
Yes.
So there's a fair bit of soapy drama involved in that, mm-hmm. And allegations of infidelity. But anyway, the point being is that Chad is there to pick up his son, and his son isn't there, and he demands that they produce him, and they're saying, well, he isn't here, and he's getting upset. And I would say he is rightfully upset. Mm-hmm. But the other man, can you look up his name for me? It's Kyle something.
Yes, it is. It's William, but he goes by Kyle Carruth.
Okay, Carruth or Carruth.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's just, you know, we've had two Kyles in the news recently. So he tells Mr. Reed to get off the property, and he won't. And so Kyle goes back inside, and Mr. Reed continues to become more agitated, and he's talking about how he will subpoena everyone. And then Kyle comes out again, and he's got a pistol caliber carbine. And this is where things get fuzzy in terms of who's right and who's wrong, at least as far as I'm concerned. And this is where things get tragic, because, the monkey brain has taken over. Because on the one hand, I really think that Kyle Carruth should not have... You know, he left the situation, and then he came back with a gun. Mm-hmm. And so that makes things a lot more tense. On the other hand, in Texas, you're allowed to do this. You know, you are allowed to use lethal force in defense of property and There might, in fact, be a castle doctrine going on. But still, you know, again, all of this could have been avoided if he had just gone inside, locked the door, and called 911.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't. He comes out. And all of this could have been avoided if Chad Reed had gone, oh, you've got a gun. You know what? Let's just call the police. And left.
Mm-hmm.
But neither side did the smart thing. And in fact, Chad Reed got very offended by this, and he got angry, and they started bumping chests. And, you know, if you're bumping chests with someone who has a gun, and this was not a pistol. This was, I believe, a Ruger pistol caliber carbine.
Ruger PCC, yes.
And so they're bumping chests, and so the gun isn't aimed at Chad yet, but it's in the low ready position, and Chad basically sort of hip checks it to the side so that the barrel is extending past his leg. And you know, they are nipple to nipple. And, you know, this is the sort of thing that if you've ever seen it in real life, it's like, yeah, they are definitely going to have a fight now unless someone breaks it up. They are not going to resolve this any other way. And we've introduced a gun into the mix.
Mm-hmm.
And then Chad Reed makes it worse by essentially daring Kyle Carruth to shoot him. And it's one of these, you had better shoot me because otherwise I'm going to take that gun from you and shoot you myself. So there's a bit of a struggle for the gun. And I don't know if the gun goes off accidentally or Carruth fires a warning shot at the guy's feet.
From my observation, like, he clearly makes a sight picture and puts a round between his feet.
Mm-hmm. That's how it looked to me.
You could see him. You could see him crate his neck just before the shot. The shot into the deck goes off, and it really looks like he's making a sight picture.
And again, a sensible person would go, "Oh, he has pulled the trigger. Mm-hmm. I should probably not be here." But instead, Chad Reed goes for the gun, and they tussle for it, and Reed actually manages to, almost like an Olympic hammer throw, he spins Carruth around and throws him off the patio.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Carruth manages to maintain his footing, but okay, so now it is escalated to battery, and there's obviously a pretty... and so obviously there is some degree of disparity of physical force, because of the way he so easily spun this smaller man off. I mean, I think Chad is like a foot on this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so the predictable thing happens. Chad regains his footing. He acquires his sight picture. And I'm sorry, Kyle acquires his footing. I'm going to start again. And so the unfortunate predictable thing happens. Kyle keeps his footing, acquires a sight picture, and shoots Chad once, center mass, and Chad drops. And this is where things get really strange to me, because neither of the women filming do anything. So, like, you've got the current wife who's in the car, and she says, you know, "I saw what you did, Kyle, I'm recording it," and I believe the ex-wife is the one in white off to the side. Yes. There's another woman inside who's filming it from inside. I don't know who she is. But neither woman, you know, react to this. You would think that the wife would go, "Oh my God, you shot my husband," mm-hmm. and would do something. You know, Kyle is saying, "I didn't want to do any this. I told you to get off my property." And then at some point after that, the current wife gets out of the car, calls 911, and then according to her, that's when she realizes he's been shot dead. And she was under the assumption, while I know that there are people who are this ignorant, first of all, you live in Texas. Secondly, you heard the gunshots. I don't know how you could, as she says, think it was a stun gun or a paintball gun, but that's what she claimed. And then when she got out and went to his body, she realizes that he has been shot. And I don't know if he was shot dead right there, or if maybe he could have been saved if someone had done some speedy first aid. We may find out about that later in the trial.
I would have my doubts, because he went down pretty hard and pretty fast, and it was definitely a center of mass shot. So chances are he got something very vital.
I would say most likely, but it's kind of chilling that no one even attempted to do anything. They were more involved in filming it, and that bothers me.
I have definitely been in situations like this where, yeah, people get measuring their Johnsons, and they do that. Oh, that chest to chest thing. It's one of those, like, that doesn't look tough, or like, I don't understand it. But it happens. It's human nature, because I've seen it happen a lot. And then when one person takes a swing and suddenly people start hitting each other, that's when suddenly the world goes from calm to, oh my God, what are they doing? They've crossed that line. And this crossed that line. I mean, maybe it crossed that line so hard and so fast that, like, oh, we can't even see the line from where we're standing. Did we cross the line yet? but it is definitely, I don't know if he's justified. I think there will be an argument to be made for that. But the moral judgment behind that is absolutely on the, I mean, we could argue that he was, Chad was agitated and was, you know, a threat, or, you know, who knows if there's allegations of abuse, you know, in the marriage and all that. We would assume that Kyle would know some intimate details of this failed marriage. But the fact that, yeah, he went inside, and it was one of those, why wouldn't he just tell everyone, just get inside and we'll lock the doors. And, you know, we've told you your piece. Mm-hmm. He's not here. We can't do anything about that. Please go away. And if he does not go away, you call the police, and he's trespassed, and they will take him away. And maybe he'll subpoena people for courts and stuff like that. But either way, it's going to be a whole lot less of a legal pain in the butt than the fact that right now you've got a dead man on your porch. And you could argue that he came out with a gun to run them off. I've certainly answered strange knocks on my door with a firearm in hand. I generally try to keep it concealed. One instance was all the lights were off in my house, and someone started ringing my doorbell, and so I went downstairs to see who it was with a 1911 in my hand. And when I saw that it did not appear to be a threat, and I opened the door just slightly to talk to them, I made sure that the gun was in my hand behind the door, so that it did not get to that point where, what are you doing pointing a gun at me? You don't need to know about the gun until you need to know about the gun. And they never needed to know about the gun. The fact that they were getting chest to chest and he had the gun in his hand, and the fact that it was a long gun, like, you need to, if you grab that barrel, that's a lot of leverage. And so the idea that he could possibly break his grip and take control of that gun, if he wanted to, especially when literally, like, the center of mass of the gun was at his thigh.
That's actually what happened. They were struggling for the gun, and he spun, Chad spun Kyle off the porch. Mm-hmm. I don't think he intended to spin him off. I think he intended to wrest the gun out of his hand.
Maybe.
And so it's going to be interesting watching this unfold. What Kyle Carruth did may have been legal. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. This entire thing is fuzzy to me, because it seemed like, to use a borrowed term, which may not be correct here, it seemed like they were both mutual combatants. But even if what he did was legally correct, I still feel that both of them made very tragic and easily avertible decisions. You know, again, he didn't have to come out, and Chad could have backed down. And so, regardless of the legality of it, I'm really not sure who's at fault, because I kind of want to blame both of them, really.
That's where I can't land too.
And so I think it's going to be interesting from a scholarly point of view to watch this case play out.
Yeah. Yep. And just a life lesson. I mean, obviously we have Kyle Rittenhouse. He has been exonerated. He is a free man. And yet The news is talking a whole lot of trash about him. There is a story that we'll cover if it turns it. Right now it's a non-story, but it might turn into a story of people at the college that he is attending via online courses. He's not even physically there. Are raising a stink about the fact that Kyle is a member of the student body there. I mean, it's just these are things that follow you. I mean, George Zimmerman's had multiple attempts on his life after that. These are things you don't want to get involved with. And just because it's legal doesn't necessarily mean it's the best idea. I mean, even in Massachusetts, we have a castle doctrine. So somebody enters my home unlawfully via breaking and entering. So somebody breaks a window, breaks a door, or something enters my home. I am legally allowed to assume that they are a deadly threat, and which means that I can shoot them. But that's not my first priority. My first priority is getting them out of the house. However they want to get away and not be a threat is fine by me. If it means that I shoot them dead on the floor, that's how it's going to be. But that's not the optimal situation. And I was just watching a YouTube video the other day where a guy was talking about how, he was, I'll give away a little bit more. He was chuckling about the just rack the 12 gauge pump action shotgun and the burglar will poop their pants and run away. And he certainly touched on the, well, if they're determined and all that, or they just don't hear it, then it's not going to really do a whole heck of a lot. But then he talked about the fact of the giving away your position and all of that. And that's one of the first things in my illegal entry into my home position is to give away my position, is to flip on lights, is to let people know, is to shout my presence there. I might be quiet in the instance when I gather all my family into a central location that's defensible, but the whole point is let them know, just in case you thought this was an unoccupied house, it is not. It is an occupied house, and therefore, if I see them, they know they're in an occupied house. And if they come after me, they're not there to steal my stereo. They're there to do something else. And so therefore I would feel much more justified in using lethal force. But also it gives them an opportunity to, maybe this isn't the place where I want to be, and they will leave, which is the better opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
This is just a sad story.
It is, but we've got something that's a lot better, and you found this. I'm going to let you run with it, but I want to read the title because it makes me happy. ABC poll, Young Americans Support for Gun Control Craters. Ooh.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that gives me pleasant shivers. Craters. What a delightful verb.
Yeah, and I will say right now, I got this for, I was working out this morning, and I had my earbuds in, and I was listening to Stephen Kutowski's The Reload podcast. It's a great show, by the way. If you need another podcast in your repertoire after you listen to this, to my dulcet tones, go check out Stephen. He runs a really good show, and they do a little news roundup, and this is one of the news roundups that they were talking about. And I said, you know what? That's pretty cool. And of course, also, he is an astounding journalist. So just, I always talk about, you know, links are in the show notes. He's got all his sources listed in there. So this is a great little article on there. But yes, an ABC poll went through and essentially is showing that, that the gun control support for gun rights is dropping amongst young Americans, and of course my first thought is, of course it is, but I'm glad to hear it, because let's be honest, it's one of the charters of the Assorted Calibers podcast. I want this to be the home for all people. We all can be here together under different politics, so long as our politics all agree that the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And again, if you are an originalist libertarian and you're noting that, yeah, you know, when the Constitution was written, they had letters of marque. They wanted private citizens to hunt pirates with warships. And so, yeah, the idea that we would have any real gun restrictions seems pretty ridiculous. And then if you're, you know, more of a, you know, hunter, collector, all that, of course, the right to own firearms. And if you want to carry them, that's fine. And if you are some of our more left-wing people and you're thinking that the police are racist and are a problem and society is coming apart and there's people that are targeting peaceful protesters and all that, why would you not want to have a gun? Like there's not really any angle where giving up a firearm is putting you in a better position. So why would people support that?
Okay, which has very little to do with the article, but okay.
Well, give me your take, Aaron.
Okay, weird. So you are or were a scientist, mm-hmm. and so you understand better than I do about statistics and probability and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as I love the title about gun control cratering, this doesn't seem like a crater to me. I mean, okay, there is a drop of 15 points between 2018 and now, and it's the lowest level of support since 2014, and that's great. But I don't know, when I hear the word cratering, I think like 80 to 90% of people, you know, hate it. And so that's not really what I'm seeing here. So maybe you can explain that, you know, how probability is, you know,
well,
such and such.
I think so. I will say right now, my weak point in this is that I generally don't follow public opinion polls because I don't care. If, you know, if everybody in the world thinks we need to ban AR-15s, it doesn't mean that they're right. And we've certainly been in many times in this country where we wanted stuff that was not the correct thing. It could very be. Certainly, I'm looking at the graph at the very bottom of this article where it essentially shows the all-time low. The delta value is extremely high. Like that is a very, very steep drop at the in that last data set. And again, it's going down low.
Well, that's true, but that's a difference of 60 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm talking about literally from the point where it's like 29 to 19. That's kind of a crater, and I haven't looked. Certainly, when I look at this graph, you see the bit from 1971 to looks like 1979. There's a big old drop, and I'm not really exactly sure what happened there.
If I had a guess, I would say that was the Reagan assassination attempt.
No, Reagan would be after that. There's an increase in gun control there. Cause I think Reagan was 82, 83.
That's what I'm talking about. I thought you were talking about why it suddenly went up after going down.
Oh, yes. Yep. No, that's certainly a great observation. I was just looking at the, where it says 41 to 37. That's still during the last like couple of years of the Carter administration.
Yep. And so that's what I think happened. It was going down, it was going down, it was going down. And then, what's his name? Mm-hmm. Shot Reagan and Jim Brady. And then we had the effects of the Brady Group trying mm-hmm. to restrict handguns back when it was called Handgun Control Incorporated. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I think that is.
Yeah, no, that seems absolutely right. But I'm just looking over the graph and looking at just the delta values, which is just the mm-hmm. rate of change, the steepness of the curve. And overall, I'm with the exception of that little bit towards the end of the Carter administration, I'm not seeing anything even remotely like that. So I think that's the true significance is that big old drop, because I think in the end, there's only so much, there's only so much change you're going to have. You're never going to have everybody suddenly all being, you know, crazed gun nuts in an area. You know, you've still got people that are interested in gun control in Texas. And of course, there's, you know, crazy people like me who are Second Amendment advocates in Massachusetts, and I'm hardly alone. So that's what I am seeing. And again, I'm happy to see it dropping because it makes sense to me. And I'm glad that what makes sense to me is pulling out in public opinion. Well, speaking of young Americans, a lot of them are new shooters. And so you go to all the trouble to get a gun, but now you want to get better with it. But where do you shoot it? Xander gives us his independent thoughts on this topic.
Welcome to Independent Thoughts with yours truly, Xander Opal. I've not joined any shooting clubs or such, since I figured I can just go to a safe spot with a nice hill for a backstop on family land and take care of target practice there. The problem I'm running into, though, is twofold. By the time I'm done with work, it's dark out, or the weather is too rotten to practice in. This is giving me new appreciation for the plight folks in places like Chicago or New York have. Legislation has prevented indoor ranges from opening up, raising the barrier for firearms owners or would-be firearms owners. Often, cities or states have so-called reasonable training requirements for the license to exercise a constitutional right. Except, there is no place for someone who is not affluent to get the training at for a reasonable cost of time and money. There's a monetary cost to travel out of town by cab or Uber and back if you live in a place where a car of your own isn't necessary. There's an even steeper cost in time to this. Folks on the lower end of income have to spend more hours a day and more days a week working to make ends meet. That means less time for physical and mental recovery, taking care of one's home, grocery shopping, and other day-to-day necessities. It's also harder to get time off for many of those jobs. And I suspect most folks wouldn't risk getting fired by insisting because I need to get training for a gun license. I doubt there's any grand conspiracy. Rather, it is a stack-up of problems with good intention and law. Much like laying out a hardwood floor by putting boards end-to-end you cut off, and not accounting for the bit the saw takes off and other mismeasurements. Eventually, when you get to the other end of the room, you're several inches short of the wall rather than everything fitting neatly. And you're out of boards. Concerns about noise and safety are honestly overblown. The fragrance of a bakery drifts further than the sound of people putting holes in paper from a distance. Proper construction is easy to verify to ensure that stray bullets don't escape from the range area. HVAC will keep smoke and such down sufficiently for the average person as well. This can also help with budget-constrained police. Why maintain a range at their expense when an officer can just go down the block to the friendly neighborhood gun range for qualification, training, or practice? Have fun, be safe, and I hope I gave you something to think about.
So for our listeners who don't have the benefit of looking at our show notes, this segment was titled Carnegie Hall Denied.
Yes, it was a brilliant title, because Aaron, how do you get to Carnegie Hall?
Practice, practice, practice.
And I got to say, this one hit close to home, because I've been talking a little bit about the new shooter that I've taken under my wing, and I've been literally taking him under my wing because he has to come to my club as my guest to shoot, because my club evidently has filled up and it's not taking any new membership. And there's a bunch of clubs that are in his area that also aren't taking new membership. And he's like, I don't know where I'm going to shoot if it isn't for hanging out with old Weirdbeard. So it's a pain in the butt. And this being Metro Boston, like, yeah, it's not like you can go find a sand pit like I used to do in Maine and just go shoot there.
So I actually have an idea. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't work for every city, but it would work for a city like New York, where there is a harbor that's part of the city. So, you know, you want to go shooting, but you aren't able to because there are no shooting ranges within the city. So what some enterprising soul can do, and please, I understand this will take a lot of money. This is, most people couldn't afford this, but we're not exactly talking Elon Musk money, but you're going to have a lot of discretionary, basically, FU money. So what you do is you buy a shipping boat. I don't mean like a little yacht. I mean one of those things that you transport cargo in.
Mm-hmm.
You travel outside the city, preferably into like international waters, and you drop anchor. And you convert that ship into a shooting range, among other things. So like you build up the bulkhead, and you rip out a lot of the cargo area, and you turn that into a shooting range. It'll take a lot of money, but neither the state nor the city can do anything about it because you aren't in their locale anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And heck, you could probably even make some money just ferrying people there and back. So it's a workaround. And I would love to find some pro Second Amendment millionaire decide, hey, let's do that. Because this sort of thing happened a lot in the early days of rock and roll. Back when various places wanted to prevent rock and roll from being broadcast, should have various pirate stations. And there was a very famous pirate station whose name escapes me at the moment, but it was in England. Well, they broadcast to England. They were actually somewhere like out in the English Channel in some sort of old North Sea decommissioned oil rig or whatever. But I mean, it was literally a chunk of metal and concrete out in international waters, and nothing could be done about it because, you know, they were in international waters. And I feel like something like this could work, but oh my God, that would take so much money.
It would.
But but if you are a pro 2A billionaire, Donald Trump Jr., then, you know, this could happen.
And but by the way, I wanted to chime in real quick and say that there was an excellent film. And let me just make sure that this is the one that I watched. Yes, The Boat That Rocked was a film. Was about the pirate radio station in the North Sea. And also I will note that Bucket Hingley of the ska band The Toasters, who grew up in England, has a song called Pirate Radio that is about him as a young boy listening to pirate radio late at night.
So could I get at least one ooh from you regarding this idea?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't want to poop on it too much, but I'm just thinking about all the logistics of it and all that. It's a great concept, but at the same time, I don't know how much of a dearth there is of shooting ranges in like New York. I know Chicago is pretty bad, and I don't know how it would work in the Great Lakes. But also just the ocean is such a harsh mistress that it's one of those like, oh, that brings in so many challenges, going through with that. It certainly is interesting, but also it's one of those all the difficulty it would take to ferry yourself out to, especially if you were going out past the Hague line, to it. Wouldn't it just be easier if you were in New York City to drive to Pennsylvania, or if you're in Massachusetts to drive to New Hampshire, et cetera, et cetera?
Oh, fine.
But I do like the fantastical nature of it. It is certainly exciting about the shooting club vessel. I'd wear a funny hat when I went to it.
Well, you're a big poopy head weird.
I mean, I am.
And in related news, David is here with a segment that I like to call Silent But Deadly.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. In this segment, I'd like to talk about air guns. They have a much broader and more interesting history than the 177 and 22 caliber target and pest control arms we're most familiar with today. There is considerable debate about the initial development of the air gun. Many historians consider them to have come on the scene sometime in the mid-1500s. Few examples have survived from that time, of course, and of those, most are in museums. The earliest recognized air guns fell into the same two categories we use today, spring-powered and compressed air. Spring-powered guns were fairly low power, but could be extremely accurate at short range. Therefore, their use was generally relegated to indoor target ranges. Compressed air or pneumatic guns were another story. Over the years, their power and reliability improved to the point where they could be used for hunting. In fact, this became the fashion among European nobility of the time. Compressed air guns powerful enough to cleanly take stag and wild boar were produced to meet this need. The chief advantages over black powder, then as now, were their resistance to weather and near-silent operation. Because of these advantages, in many parts of Europe, commoners were specifically forbidden from owning air guns. Fast forward to the 1780s, and the Austrian army equipped an entire regiment with Ghirardoni 44 caliber repeating air rifles. The effectiveness of these soldiers was so great that reportedly Napoleon ordered any Austrian soldier captured with an air rifle to be summarily executed. France, Japan, and several other countries armed soldiers with advanced air guns as well. At the recommendation of President Thomas Jefferson, a Ghirardoni air rifle was brought along on the 1803 Lewis and Clark expedition. The Indians they met along the way were very impressed with the smokeless thunderstick that could fire 20 aimed shots without reloading, each of which was nearly silent and still powerful enough to take large game at reasonable ranges, and fired almost as fast as a shooter could pull the trigger. Nearly 200 years later, American politicians would come up with another name for a rifle with these qualities. After this heyday, American and European air guns reduced in size and power, once again becoming curiosities used for shooting paper targets, primarily indoors and generally at short ranges. Following World War II, air guns saw another resurgence. Many of the German arms companies, specifically prohibited from manufacturing firearms, turned their ingenuity to air guns instead. In 1984, air guns were added as an official event to the Olympic Games. This was due in part to the increase in firearms restrictions in Europe, but also to the ever-increasing accuracy, quality, and popularity of air guns. For the collector, there are many domestic and foreign air guns to choose from. Vintage Daisy, Benjamin, Sheridan, Crossman, and Highscore air guns are considered to be the best of the U.S. manufacturers. There was some contraction in the U.S. market over the years. Highscore went out of business in the early 1970s. Sheridan was purchased by Benjamin in 1977, and Benjamin in turn was purchased by Crossman in 1994. Vintage examples from Anschutz, BSA, Diana, and Webley & Scott are the most desired air gun brands from overseas. One of the relatively newer makers on the market is Umarex. They manufacture most of the current firearm replica air guns for companies like SIG, and have even branched out into rimfire guns. The Art of Air Gun Collecting by Robert Beeman, if you can find a copy, is considered the classic text on the subject, even though it's only 23 pages long. For general information and prices, look for the Blue Book of Air Guns. There are also books available on different manufacturers. For the do-it-yourself crowd, there are books and guides on making an air gun at home, and for the prospective air gun hunter, in addition to the 177 and 22 caliber air guns we're familiar with, there are also large caliber options capable of taking big game available on the market. For those interested, take a look at what's out there. There's an air gun for everyone. As you might expect, Weird likes the ones that expel a lot of gas.
You get me to tell borscht fart jokes.
There are some things I can't defend.
This is fair.
That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments or a comment on a past segment, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook or MeWe pages, and Aaron or Weird will make sure I get them. I am also a contributor on the Blue Collar Prepping blog, which can be found at bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
Air guns are fun. There was, at least one NRA annual meeting, maybe two, where they had, what was that name? It was a pun, like Air Control, Air Force, Air something or other, where they had the air guns that were in like .357 Magnum and .44 caliber, and everyone could take a turn shooting them, and they were powerful. Mm-hmm. They were fun. And I wanted one.
Yeah, they are impressive. And yeah, I I want one too. As a matter of fact, one year I was attempting to grow vegetables. I'm a terrible gardener, but I was attempting to grow vegetables and the rabbits ate it all. Mm-hmm. And I went, well, I may be a terrible gardener, but I'm an excellent cook. I'm going to cook me some rabbits that are fattened up from my garden. And I went on Amazon and I bought myself an air rifle and a box of pellets. And it went through, and then I got an email said, thank you, your order has been received. And then another email said, you live in Massachusetts, no gun for you. I didn't know that that was against the rules as well here.
It might not be. There are some gun manufacturers who just go, mm-hmm. Yeah, Massachusetts, they give us problems. You know what? We're not going to risk it.
Yeah, no, I've absolutely encountered that on many of occasion. But yeah, and I'm glad that David pointed out, and I loved his turn of phrase for the Grandolone air rifle, where
Grandolone,
whatever. It's furrin.
I shouldn't laugh because I'm terrible with names too, but it's like, it's a gun. It would be like calling a Beretta a Bear Eta.
You know what, Aaron? I'm going to call that for the rest of my life. Just to tick oddball off. But yeah, the Austrian air rifle was the statement of the, yeah, people today call that something different now, in the fact that, yeah, there was people talk about, oh, the founding fathers could never have imagined an AR-15. Yeah, they could. Yeah, they could. Like, before we even ratified the Constitution, the Austrian army was fielding troops with this gun that could shoot 30 or 40 times without needing to reload in rapid succession. Yeah, no, the idea of a semi-auto rifle was no big deal. And the idea that futurists like Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson could think of all of the things they thought of, but never think of the idea of a gun that could reload on its own and shoot in rapid succession is not giving them very much credit.
You know, I think what we need is an alternate history series by like Harry Turtledove or similar, where the air guns didn't go out of fashion. Mm-hmm. And we now have essentially air gun assault rifles during the American Revolution.
Yeah, because it was simply the air tank technology. Like, it's very similar to the idea of the, oh, why is it that that machine guns didn't get invented earlier? Well, they didn't get invented earlier because smokeless powder didn't get invented earlier. And you could probably, if smokeless powder was never invented, probably someone could figure out a way to make a machine gun. But as a general rule, they just get too gunky too fast that a rapid fire machine gun would choke without the advent of smokeless powder. And the same thing is it seems like the military air rifle went by the wayside simply because the air tanks weren't able to hold the charges long enough. And so if somehow someone had come up with a way to seal them up better, maybe we would have more and more an increasing air rifle technology, which would be very interesting, especially since we'd be going for more intermediate caliber type cartridges. So we might even be making assault rifles super early.
So for people who are curious, yes, it is called Air Force Air Guns, and you can find them at airforceairguns.com. But if you go there, either be prepared to dish out a lot of money or you're going to cry a lot, because they don't mess around. Most of them are over a grand. Mm-hmm. But they're so pretty.
But you could take a deer with an air gun.
Yes, you could.
Well, I'm shifting gears. I don't have a smooth segue for this one, but I will say this is something that's been in the mix for a while, because when Aaron first introduced me to Paloma Capana, she told me she's a lawyer, she's really smart, and she once sued the state of New York. And you didn't really give me a whole lot of details on that case. So I just was like, you know what, Paloma? you should come on the show and talk about that case. And there's been several instances where Paloma has come on the show to talk about that case. And when she showed up, she had a whole bunch of other ideas in her head. And I'm not going to get in her way. But finally, I got to sit down with Paloma and have her tell you about this case where she sued the state of New York. I am very pleased to welcome back to the Assorted Calibers podcast, Paloma Capanna. And Paloma, with your great law background, you said, I really want to talk about Robinson versus Sessions, and I am all ears. So let us spare no time.
Well, I think that the lead-in, and thanks for that great introduction, Weird Beard, and hello everybody listening to Assorted Calibers podcast. The lead-in that I would give for this case is it's the best case in America that nobody's ever heard of. Robinson versus Sessions is a case where I represented more than 30 plaintiffs suing the ATF, the FBI, DHS, and the U.S. Attorney Generals. And what we found out, just to give you some idea where we're going, is that every time you fill out the ATF form 4473 to purchase a firearm at a federally licensed dealer, you are actually being checked to see if you are on the terrorist screening database. Now, this case reached its endpoint in 2018. It's almost hard at this point to imagine America pre-January 6th, for those of us who are concerned about the Second Amendment or even criminal justice, you know, generally speaking. But I think that Robinson versus Sessions is perhaps more relevant now than ever, because one of the charges that we were leveling against the federal government is that we were being treated as presumptive terrorists simply because we wanted to purchase a firearm. When we first filed the case, I think we had some concern whether we were going to be characterized simply as paranoid conspiracy theorists. But what ended up happening was US DOJ admitted everything we alleged. Completely unheard of. I mean, the federal government does not ever defend a case and say, oh, yes, we did it, right? Just ask the ACLU, because from 9/11 to the point that we filed Robinson versus Sessions, the federal government had been denying everything or begrudgingly admitting certain tiny data points like, oh, yes, we collect metadata, but there's so much of it, we don't really know what's in it until we have a specific person. And if it's an American, then we get a warrant, right? This was the claim that we heard from McCabe when he gave testimony. But Robinson versus Sessions actually established fact certain that every time you do the 4473, it gets run against a terrorist screening database.
And that, of course, is there. They've talked about expanding the NICS system so that you will be denied if you are on this list that is a secret list and mm-hmm. a list that you have no way to know how you get on it. And there mm-hmm. is really not a clear avenue on how to get off of it, unless I'm mistaken.
You are correct. Absolutely correct on all of the above. And the only detail that you're missing is that even if you are in the terrorist screening database, the ATF cannot deny you at the point of purchase from completing the purchase of the firearm on that basis.
Yep. They want to change that. But also...
Well, they've wanted to change it, right? 10 years in a row... Mm-hmm. Preceding our filing of the case in 2016, 10 years in a row, Congress had specifically said, including to U.S. AG Gonzalez, remember him, no, we're not adding that to the list of disqualifications for the purchase of a firearm. So for listeners, 18 U.S.C. section 922G, repeat after me, 18 U.S.C. section 922G. We should all know this is gun owners. This is where you find the disqualifying factors. So you're convicted of a felony, you renounce your American citizenship, you're an illegal alien and not a U.S. citizen in the first place, right? These are all things that can disqualify you from owning a firearm. Congress has specifically said 10 years in a row, we're not doing it. We're not adding because there is no due process associated with the terrorist screening database. So we file this case. The DOJ admits they're doing it anyway. We're in shock. The plaintiffs and me, people around us, right? I'm out on a speaking circuit. Everybody's like, oh my gosh, this is fantastic. This is amazing. And Judge Geraci at the trial court level says, well, you don't have standing because really your plaintiffs can't demonstrate they were actually harmed by this policy. So the U.S. government is committing an illegal action against us because we seek to be law-abiding gun owners, and that's not harm. Well, it's not harm enough, right? If you could bring me a plaintiff who is actually being denied the firearm, but Judge, we can't do that because the actual policy of the FBI and the ATF in writing, and we had it and they confirmed it, is that they don't want the terrorists to know that they are watching them when they go to make a purchase. So more than 100 times, according to an ATF letter to U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein, the ATF has had a person who is a match to the terrorist screening database. They have allowed the purchase to go through, which is what the law requires. But out of 220 million checks, they come up with 112 hits in a program they're conducting illegally. And by the time we get to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York City, those three judges say, eh, that's okay. You're gun owners. You don't have a right to a gun unless you can demonstrate you have that right. Got the law completely wrong.
And another complaint to point out on this terrorist watch list, which I despise, is on a personal note, I happened to be in the city of Boston on marathon day when the improvised explosive was detonated at the finish line. And that was a very scary afternoon for me, especially with I took the train into work. And so I am standing at North Station waiting for my train to come in so I can head out into the suburbs. And I'm sitting there looking at all of these crowds of people all around me and just all packed into the train station. Everyone's waiting to get out of the city. Yes, there were the police were in high force. I mean, the cops with the MP5s were out and all that. But it's I'm wearing a backpack. We're all wearing backpacks. You know, you don't know what's going on. And it was terrifying. But I say all that to point out the fact that the brothers who were on this were not, or I think they were attempted to be put on the terrorist watch list, but whoever was running it misspelled their name. So they were effectively not on the watch list. And there have, of course, been any number of other cases that I could argue were very much acts of terror, as opposed to any other form of horrible violence, where the participants in that were not on the terrorist watch list either. So it seems that whenever I hear the terrorist watch list being brought up, it's a whole lot of regular people being flagged for various terrible reasons as being terrorists. But I don't know if there are any actual terrorists on the list.
You know, plus or minus, the question about whether the list should exist or not is a separate policy question. The primary question I continue to raise is that as someone who has a fundamental right, according to the United States Supreme Court, to at least attempt to make a purchase at a federally licensed dealer, what is the federal government programming the general public to think by making that equation that we are terrorists by definition, that the very thought that you might like to purchase a firearm puts you in the league of, for example, the New York Post story that we had Jihadi Wayne, right? Mm. Remember that newspaper cover? Wayne LaPierre on the cover of the newspaper with Osama bin Laden, the tactical equivalent, the mental equivalent, the image equivalent in terms of what federal security agencies are trying to drill down into the American general public. Now, gun sales are higher than they ever were. I mean, the FFL reported numbers to the ATF continue to steadily rise. And I think that there is less sense of personal security right now in America than I can remember during my lifetime, even in a, I think, different way than 9/11. 9/11 being, if you will, a discrete event of a single day, mm-hmm. where there was a bad guy, and the bad guy was over there, and the follow-up took place over there. And now we have, at this point, nearly 700 Americans being prosecuted by the DOJ for the events of January 6th. We have congressional inquiries that just don't stop, even though they're not actually at this point serving a particular purpose of fact finding. So I think that there's a different unease and a slightly different edginess that is coming to be affiliated with this question of protecting the Second Amendment right to own a firearm.
Yeah. I mean, that's amazing. And of course you won this case. And so,
the victory was in the loss. So we lost at the district court. We lost at the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. And then the United States Supreme Court declined to accept the case. This was shortly before President Trump, of course, was elected to office. So perhaps they would have taken it if our filing had been a couple of years later. But the victory was in the level of admission that USDOJ handed to us. As a punishment for our victory, however, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, specifically in its opinion, said, and this is not going to be published in the official reporter series. And I'm just being candid. I did not even know that the court had an ability to say an opinion wouldn't be published in the official reporter series of the court. But it wasn't. So of all the strangeness, this decision thus does not even have an F number that goes with it for easy finding in the hardcover books that are on the beautiful shelves, of law libraries across America. So this is why I say it's the best case nobody's ever heard of. It also then dovetails into a case round about that same time, shortly thereafter, where the ACLU won a major tiny victory on a piece of discovery that they got in finding out that when a background check is run against someone for the terrorist screening database, that background check actually fans out across 14,400 offices and agencies. So what we knew from Robinson versus Sessions is that when the ATF form 4473 is submitted, you run against a terrorist screening database, and it fans out to other agencies, not within the Gun Control Act as proper background check, not within the Brady Act as proper background check. It also goes out to foreign governments who are considered coalition partners, and it also goes out to private contractors. So what we did not know until the ACLU case is that, how that multiplies out is to, your private information, your detail information concerning your firearm can reach as many as 14,400 other offices and agencies, including overseas and in the hands of private contractors.
I mean, that is just amazing. And that also brings into question, I have said multiple times on the podcast that I am not necessarily opposed to background checks. I think mm-hmm. that's a segment in itself. I've talked about it sure. in length, that what the various disqualifying factors that I strongly disagree with, though there are some disqualifying factors that I'm fairly comfortable. If you are a violent criminal, yeah, the idea of saying that you shouldn't have a gun, you've kind of proven that you can't be trusted. All that being said, I've said one solution for the background check problem that I could get behind is to simply, while cleaning up the NICS system, to get rid of things that, you got caught scrubbing lobsters, so now you can never own a firearm for the rest of your life. You open it up so that just the two parties doing a private sale can access the NICS system. And this really brings a light on why another reason why that might be opposed.
Sure. We as American gun owners have a right to privacy. I'm sorry, right? I will go ahead and be apologetic. If you do not know what that form contains, you are a consumer. When you walk into that FFL, no different than going to buy bed sheets at Macy's. But when we go to purchase a firearm, we are also giving our date of birth and our place of birth. This is important information. This is if you want to be committing a fraud, if you want to be creating an alternative. You know, we see all these commercials all day long on TV, right? For identity theft. Guard your information. So whether it's a constitutional right to privacy or whether it's just plain common sense that I don't walk down the street handing that out to my neighbors, the U.S. government does not have a legal right to hand out our personal identification information to other offices, agencies, foreign governments, and private contractors where we have not given our consent for that information to be widely shared. But the gun owner, at least according to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals out of New York City, we are a second-class citizen when it comes to privacy.
Yeah. And that brings it to the larger question of privacy. And you know what? Mm-hmm. I think we've gone long enough on this subject. So you know what? I think we should have a part two where we talk about privacy in the next episode. So thank you so much for coming on the show, Paloma.
Absolutely. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And, you know, hopefully at some point we can just all do this in person with our cell phones in little spiffy metal tins at the edge of the driveway.
Wow. Yeah, I don't remember when I heard about this, but I did hear sometime in the past about how being on the terrorist watch list wouldn't prevent you from getting a gun simply because whoever was tracking you, well, if you went in to buy a gun and you were declined, they might think, oh no, they're on to me. And the three-letter agencies wanted to follow them and I guess let their plans come almost to fruition. But I didn't know about any of this other stuff. I didn't know about how when you get a background check done, this information spreads out to just an ungodly number of other agencies who have no business with this. And this is horrible. And yet, what, we can't do anything about it?
Well, I mean, so first up, I need to address the, you heard me step, you know, step on my own foot in the mm-hmm. course of this interview, and I left it in because I felt it tied in. I thought about what I do. It makes me look stupid, and you know, I'm not afraid of making myself look stupid. But the point is, like as she said, it's the case that nobody ever heard of. Like I just assumed, yeah, you won this case because this is the case that we're talking about. And like, yeah, I hadn't even heard about it enough that like I'm like, so you won it, right? No, we didn't. But it is also very interesting that this case really was kind of the end of the constant push to add the terrorist watch list and as horrible as it is to the prohibited person list for the Gun Control Act. And so you know what, we can probably thank Paloma a little bit because she did expose quite a bit of underhandedness that was going on. And again, it's, I'm also a little bit surprised. I'm not surprised on why maybe the anti-gunners are so apt to push against letting us have universal background checks, but just taking it out of the hands of the FFLs and letting it be private people as well.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcaliberspodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like the hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film tracks, and the ACP mag dump.
Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts, subscribe to us on the platform of your choice, and share the show with your friends both online and off.
You get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com, and you can also hear me on Handgun Radio, which is on the Firearms Radio Network.
And you can find me at all the usual places online, including bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com.
And thanks to Nate Spencer for our music. And you know what? Little plug for Nate. Guess what? Nate has an album. He's had it for years. It's an older album. Has an album on Spotify. So if you search Nate Spencer on Spotify, you will find more of his music. And you can actually hear him singing.
Weird. Stop being a douche and just drop a link in the show notes.
I can do that.
You will do that.
It's already done.
Good. Well, as you've just heard right now, I have proper manners, and I need to kick him in order to be half decent around other people. He wasn't raised right. So, the ways in which we were reared are assorted, and so's our podcast. And so with that, dear ladies and gentlemen, I bid you the most eloquent of benedictions. Good night.
Good night, people.
Don't interrupt me, you little... All right, that's it. That's it. You go around the shed, you cut yourself a switch, and you bring it back here. And if you bring me one that is too thin, I'm going to make you go cut me another one. I'm going to whip you with both.